Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of the Reading Muslims podcast. I'm Mohammed Abu Sarah, a PhD student at the University of Toronto Department for the Study of Religion. Today, we are lucky enough to have Professor Susan Marchant to discuss questions on Orientalism philology and its critics. The podcast episode is part of the Reading Practices Hub, which involves exploring the methods and assumptions of philologists and literary scholars. Professor Marchant is the Boyd Professor of European Intellectual History at Louisiana State University. Her areas of interest include Western civilizational, intellectual, and cultural history. Among the several books she authored, we will be focusing today on the topic of her book titled German Orientalism in the Age of Empire, Race, Religion, and Scholarship. The book was published in 2009 by Cambridge University Press. The book significantly contributes to the discussion of Orientalism inaugurated by Edward Said in the 1970s. Professor Marchant focuses on the careers and studies of the Orientalists who invested time and effort in learning to read and or to speak at least one Oriental language. She also seeks to know what it was like to be an Orientalist and what motivated some well-educated Germans to be involved in this field of study, especially when it was largely unfashionable and usually unprofitable to do so. She illustrated that there is no monolithic German discourse about the Orient and that Orientalist discourses varied according to different circumstances. She combines her discussion of the rise of German Orientalism with an investigation of the surrounding cultural and political life. Besides the rich information in the book, it also offers an important analysis and provides a new perspective of the history of Orientalism. We are grateful to have the opportunity to speak to her today. Professor Susan Marchant, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Mohammed. I'm so glad to be part of this podcast.
Thank you. So to get started, I want to ask about the main theme of your book. Why did you choose German Orientalism in specific, and what makes the experience of German Orientalism unique and more relevant to the topic of our hub? How important was the field of Islamic studies to these German Orientalism?
Okay, so let me take on those questions sequentially. I got into this topic in a different way than many. That is, I am not an Orientalist, and by that term, I'm using the 19th century definition, which meant basically every sort of philology that was not Western European or classical. I got into the field actually from studying the history of classical scholarship and classical archaeology. And I noticed in that field the critical approach to it taken by people who were trained as Orientalists, people who were biblical scholars, people who were scholars of Islamic texts, who did have to work hard to compete in classical studies as well. They all knew Greek and Latin and often many, many other languages as well. But they were outside of the sort of lovely and sunny world of classical studies, which was so much more influential in the wider culture. So I thought that I would work on German Oriental studies in particular, because it really developed in the shadow of classical studies for the most part. And also developed out of a tradition that really is nowhere in Edward Said's Orientalism, and that is Reformation biblical criticism. Now, in this, the Germans were a little different than some of the Western Europeans, who much earlier on had been translating Arabic texts, for example, scientific texts, medical texts, also Bibles, back into the 14th and 15th century, to use for their own scientific purposes, but also to use sometimes as polemics against the Islamic world. The Germans were not very heavily engaged in that effort, with the exception of a few Austrians on the Ottoman border. So the German traditions developed in a rather different way, with a much deeper focus on the oldest texts in every tradition, and especially on Oriental texts that bore heavily on the Bible. That meant early Arabic texts, but by early Arabic texts, I mean pre-Islamic Arabic texts. That also meant Coptic, that meant various kinds of Syriac, and eventually cuneiform and hieroglyphics. But the German tradition was rather more centered in the universities, rather more focused on biblical exegesis, and has always had a slightly different character because of those sorts of interests. And that meant that Edward Said's Orientalism simply didn't have a place for this kind of Orientalism. It was much more focused on, or is much more focused on, post-Napoleonic French and British studies, both literary and scholarly. But the German tradition really poses a very strong contrast in many respects. And since it was the leading tradition by at least the 1830s, that really cued me into the flaws and difficulties in Said's argument, because it simply left out a very major tradition. I just want to note that it was not the only tradition left out by Said, who of course couldn't cover everything, but there are also very important traditions of Dutch Orientalism and also Russian, Italian. All of those really need further study and have been given further study since Said's book came out.
Wonderful. So since you mentioned Edward Said, he has a critique of philology. And in the last decades, multiple academics also criticized philology. But before getting into this kind of critique, can you please tell us what philology is and why it has gotten more attention?
Certainly. And it's a very interesting question, Mohamed, because for many years, as I was first studying the history of German scholarship, philology was used very often and prominently in Germany, but it fell out of the vocabularies, really, of the Americans and the British and, to some extent, the French. And I think that that was a reaction to a definition of philology that's very narrow and was not the one that was operative for the 16th century forward. For the 16th century forward, philology was the study of words, particularly historical words, in the interest of understanding any text. But everyone knew that to understand certain words, you also had to understand many things about the culture. So you had to understand what certain plants' names were, but also how they were used. In order to decipher a text, you really had to understand place names, for example. You had to understand the ways in which words changed over time and concepts changed their meaning over time. So an old-fashioned philologist was really a humanist, what we call a humanist, someone who was engaged in the interpretation of texts, especially ancient texts, and trying to understand them, trying to get their deep meaning. Now, as specialization kicked in, of course, it was harder and harder to do all of this. And we've had disciplines spin off since then, so that we have literary studies that are really separate from philology or linguistics, which has some aspects of the old philology, but also many different new interests, mathematical and psychological and physiological as well. So the old term philology, which did persist in Germany, was a much wider term than the one Said was reacting to. And the form of philology he was reacting to was one that was narrowly grammatical, I would say, and defined chiefly just by a kind of positivistic collection of words to put them into a lexicon or a dictionary. And of course, that went on, particularly in the 19th century. There was a lot of work of that sort. But one of the things that's forgotten, I think, is just how crucial that work was to the kind of work that we can do now. it was ground clearing. You had to understand what words in, let's say, a European scholar would have to understand what words in ancient Persian meant before he or she could write a history of ancient Persia. So all of those definitions of philology have gotten a bit entangled, but the old, more capacious definition is the one that I work from.
Amazing. Thank you so much for that illustration. So in your book, you also illustrated that German Orientalists were not exclusively philologists and that their approaches changed over time. Could you also please give us an overview of these changes and the motivations behind them?
Gladly. So I mentioned just now specialization. We often forget about this, but as more and more knowledge poured into Europe, more and more information was collected, books were purchased and or ransacked from other nations, as more and more Europeans traveled and collected geographical information or zoological or botanical information, the disciplines began to specialize and to split apart. So by the 1820s, for example, you really see the divergence of Oriental and classical studies, which you had not seen previously. And then modern European philology also begins to develop as a field. Similarly, also specialized geography begins to develop its own particular interests and subject matter. Not until the end of the 19th century do we really have a field that calls itself anthropology. And much of that begins as physical anthropology, but gradually that also separates itself off. And archaeology becomes more and more a separate field as more Europeans are able to go out to other countries and take away their artifacts. And that means that that more and more scholars by the end of the 19th century are able to draw on a wide variety of what in German were called realien, or real things, objects, particular material details. And that does begin to transform the study of philology as more of the people in the discipline are no longer armchair scholars, but are engaged in material culture and become more interested in comparison, for example, or in anthropological questions or archaeological questions. And all of that massively enriches what Europe knows about the other parts of the world. Of course, all of that is also very much shaped by imperial extension and imperial practices. I would never want to deny that. And that too shapes some of its interests. But it does mean a huge change in the kinds of subjects also that scholars are interested in and able to study with precision.
Sure. So let's now move to to talk about the critique of philology. Since the publication of Edward Said's famous Orientalism, there were multiple attacks on philology, as that philology, for example, demonstrates Western prejudice. Some academics even went farther and called to get rid of this approach. And this critique also coincides with or even led to the rise of social history, subaltern studies, and anthropology, especially anthropology of Islam. I wonder, how would you navigate these critiques and what could be a possible response to them?
Okay, excellent question. I think that one of the problems that the critics don't recognize is how much philology is an iterative process, and also one that has been massively enriched by intercultural conversation, and finally by the ways in which Europeans have modified their abilities to understand other cultures through other cultures' lenses. So one of the certainly reasonable criticisms made of philology was that, at least at first, it understood most of those foreign languages using grammatical principles drawn from European texts, or they used biblical paradigms, or were interested in only certain things because they related to Europe, and left out texts that were, let's say, of interest much more to a Chinese audience than to a European audience, or much more to an Islamic audience than to a European audience. Some of that work was certainly tainted by European prejudices and interests, and by grammatical kinds of models that were drawn exclusively from Europe. But over time, scholars learned that they needed to do more. They needed to find those local grammars. They couldn't get a good handle on text without using Arabic grammars or Hindu grammars. They needed to have Sanskrit grammars. They needed to have the local culture show them how to understand better. And as time has passed, I think that has happened, and we've failed to give those scholars in those fields credit for learning from past mistakes and having the opportunity and the will and the interest in learning about another culture and talking to people who have local knowledge or fluency in the native language. And they have gotten better and have become more authentic in their understandings of other cultures. They're never going to be perfect. But the thing I most object to in that critique of philology is the essential understanding that we can't ever have a full understanding of someone else's culture, or a decent, or a basis for communication with another culture, and that everyone needs to only study themselves. And that, I think, is just a tragedy to teach students that there is no hope for intercultural communication. What a disaster. So that's the criticism that I would have of that school of thought. I understand where it comes from real and valid resentment against many, many decades of abuse by Europeans of their privileges, but people have learned from their mistakes and can do better. And I think we need to keep that hope alive.
Thank you so much for that. So the last question aims to map out philology in relation to other methods. And let's just take an example today of philology and intellectual history. So you, as intellectual historian, how would you distinguish philology, the subject you studied, from intellectual history, which is your approach? They both work on texts. They both pay special attention to the content of these texts. But are there major differences between philology and intellectual history?
I would say that there now are. And that has to do perhaps primarily with specialization, but also with the development of certain kinds of skills. So I have an enormous respect, as you can probably tell, for philologists today. They do amazing work in languages that are often very difficult to learn, and they try to learn them deeply, fluently, completely, so that they can translate, for example, write edition notes, create compendia. That's a kind of work that's not very much validated or respected in academia, I'm afraid, these days, because we're looking for something perhaps more flashy. But that work is absolutely critical, and we couldn't do without it. Mesopotamian cuneiform specialists, for example, have remarkable skills. We need to really appreciate how much they do just to decipher those tablets. It's not an easy matter. But they can't do everything. And once they have done their kind of ground clearing work to create translations and editions and those sorts of things, intellectual historians can and do profit enormously from using those works to try to understand the bigger picture, to put in a wider context, and to try perhaps to compare ideas, to follow the ideas over time. Of course, we also need to learn the language that we're working in and learn it as well as possible, but we don't have to have the same kind of very nitty-gritty knowledge of roots and phonetics and pronunciation and change over time. We can work out from that that foundation and do new things, but it's in large part because they have done some of that ground clearing work that we can progress farther. I would not in any way think of myself as a philologist. I simply don't have the skills, but there are intellectual historians who are closer and farther away also from that kind of close textual reading. It kind of depends on the focus sometimes. If you perhaps are a scholar of poetry, for example, and work on one particular poet, often you're closer to being a philologist. Someone like me who, as you mentioned about the German Orientalism book, works on many different biographies of many different scholars in many different fields. I'm farther away from that kind of close work, but it's all necessary, it's all good. And it's all humanistic learning.
Wonderful. That's very enjoyable and helpful podcast and discussion. Professor Marchand, thank you very much for joining us today.
I'm most happy to do it, Mohamed.